Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Apex Towing versus Tolan. Justice Owen is not sitting.
May it please the court, Mr. Raymond Blackwood will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm Ray Blackwood representing the Apex petitioners. The first question this court may wish to consider is why does the Hughes jurisprudence require judicial finality? The answer is clarity, efficiency, and predictability. These are important policy reasons for limitations rules because if clients lose valuable substantive rights, the claim in this case is an excessive one.
Didn't we cross that bridge in Murphy? Haven't we already created one exception? And are you asking us to overrule Murphy and get back to Hughes?
No, Your Honor, we're not asking you to overrule Murphy. Our view of Murphy is that it's an accounting malpractice case. That the statements therein that are relied on by the respondents are dicta, and so they are not binding on this court as a precedent. In fact, the last five cases that this court decided involving tolling rules for legal malpractice all strongly held for a bright line rule, which started with the Hughes rule, and that rule is judicial finality.
As a practical matter, why should we treat accountant malpractice cases any differently than attorney malpractice cases?
Well, you know, that's the issue this court looked at in Murphy. This is not an accounting malpractice case. I would sort of agree that that there might be a lot of reasons you should, and maybe Murphy should have been decided another way. There wasn't 3 justices dissenting in that case. However, there are some reasons perhaps that would support it. There is no accountant client privilege. There is a legal malpractice attorney client privilege, and as Justice Abbott pointed out in the last argument, there's an imperilment of the attorney-client privilege if you force people to file another lawsuit.
But
while
none of that is indicated as the reasoning in the Murphy case.
No, all Murphy says, Your Honor, in my judgment, is that there's a tolling rule. It's never been applied outside the legal malpractice context. Should we apply it to accounting malpractice? And the court answered no. Then, in discussing the rationale for that, the court described the Hughes case. There was a misdescription of the case, that the Hughes never involved an attorney termination rationale at all. And in fact, in Hughes and in Gulf Coast, another case this court decided on legal malpractice tolling, both cases, it was clear in the facts of that case that the lawyers were terminated more than 2 years before the case was filed.
But you're asking us to confine Murphy to accounting malpractice, and I guess my question is, on what policy basis would you do that? It would be the attorney-client privilege basis?
Well, on the basis that the statements of Murphy were dicta and they're not binding, and on the policy reasons that were enunciated in the five cases, the last five times this court looked at legal malpractice tolling, and those policies are clarity, the importance of clarity, giving the legal system a chance to work out the underlying case in the client's favor so that you can avoid unnecessary litigation, so that maybe the malpractice case doesn't have to be filed. And that even benefits the malpractice defendants, because the system may work out things in such a way that either the law has changed, and so what might have been malpractice no longer is, or maybe some other thing works out and so there's no damages. Also, an important policy reason is that was enunciated by this court in Sanchez, which is a 95 case of this court, which was not discussed at all in Murphy. Another policy reason is that clients shouldn't be forced to monitor their attorney's work product. And the settlement rule espoused by the respondents in this case would force clients to have constantly monitor their lawyers, because under their rule, limitation stops when there's a settlement agreement, and rather than at the end of the underlying case, which is the bright line rule of Hughes. And so that would force, and they're even arguing that oral agreements could be enforceable under certain circumstances, including this case. So that would force clients to have to record every conversation that the lawyer has, every fax, every email they'd have to be copied on. That would increase transaction costs, and that would be bad policy. So that the policy of Sanchez is don't make clients have to monitor their lawyer's work product. Give the lawyers the chance to have professionalism and some independence and not to be unduly hampered by having to constantly have their clients monitor them. So it's the judicial finality rule of Hughes and the four other cases subsequently decided by this court that does provide a bright line rule. The Apex petitioners believe there is such a thing as a bright line rule, and that bright line rule in the context of legal malpractice.
But you agree that legal malpractice in the context of litigation may be different kinds of acts and omissions and lead to different kinds of damages?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's not one kind of malpractice that leads to one kind of damage.
That's correct. That's correct.
Then isn't the Hughes rule overly broad to the extent that it applies finality of judgment to every situation, regardless of what the underlying facts are, and in some instances where it doesn't make sense?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the policies of the judicial finality are satisfied by tolling until the terminal point of the underlying case. And I think that the policies do provide important reasons. Like I said, judicial efficiency to let...
I understand, but you're saying that Hughes is the bright line rule.
Yes.
And it should be applied on its face for what it says, that we wait till the appellate court to finish with the case in order for the statute to commence running. I guess it's a tolling provision, so the injury may have occurred at some point in time before, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in some instances, however, we may not need to wait until final judgment in order to protect the policies of Hughes. So should, two questions then. Is it necessary to modify Hughes in some way so it's not always applied in a case involving final judgment, or should we do, as I think you heard some argument in the previous case, that we should look at the underlying policy reasons that were stated in Hughes to determine whether or not the rule should be applied?
No, Your Honor. APEX submits that it would promote lots of litigation, increased transaction costs, uncertainty in the law, which is not good for limitations law. So there should not be a case-by-case basis. APEX submits that there should...
Most limitations issues are decided on a case-by-case basis.
Well, there's always an application of the facts to the governing rule. But the rule that's in question before this court today, in fact, Mr. Hatchell wants to overrule it, but the rule that's in force since 1991 under the Hughes case is that if you've got a claim for legal malpractice involving litigation, that the limitations is told until the end of the underlying case. And it said, in fact, it said during the pendency of the case, it's told. That's what Hughes said.
Well, so that means if it's a bright line rule, that means if we have a multi-party case and one party, the party who ultimately is going to sue his or her attorney for malpractice, that their claim is resolved and it goes away. But the remainder of the litigation is still pending. And it doesn't reach judgment until 2 years later, and then it goes through the appellate process over the next 2 years. So that means, with the bright line rule, we have no exception because we have to wait until all appeals have been exhausted and the case is finally resolved. So that person who's been out of litigation for 4 years doesn't have to start worrying about suing their lawyer until the appellate process is exhausted.
That's correct, Your Honor, because the point of judicial efficiency is you need to have a bright line rule so there's certainty, so clients know when their case is resolved.
Aren't there also competing considerations, though, and that is that the law has an interest in preventing stale claims from being prosecuted and urging people to timely bring their lawsuits while witnesses are available, while documents are still available and haven't been destroyed, and all of those kinds of things. We have competing considerations, and under a strict application of Hughes, we're going to let someone whose issue has been resolved, whose case is over, wait 4 or 5 years before they have to even start thinking about suing their lawyer.
Well, Your Honor, there's an easy solution to that, which is just if very often there's other claims, but if truly this thing is taken care of and you have nothing left in that case, you can just sever out the case, and then under Hughes, the case is over, and then you go forward.
Well, I don't want my case severed. I'd rather wait and think about suing my lawyer for 5 years.
Well, I mean, that's the point of rules, is you can always come up with some case that doesn't satisfy the... That seems to challenge the thing, but you're gonna if you
yeah,
if you
my question to you is, I understand that we're talking about application of rules to fact situations. However, if a rule does not purport to deal fairly, taking all policy considerations, taking into account all the policy considerations, if the rule is so broad or has effects that are absurd, then, in fact, the rule doesn't work, and perhaps the rule should be something narrower or should be changed or in some way.
I agree, Your Honor. If this court, I think the court should err on the side of a bright-line rule. However, if you're presented with circumstances that are totally absurd and unjust, obviously you don't want to have an injustice taking place. But I think that you should be sparing in creating exceptions, and the facts of this case don't provide any basis for such exceptions.
Why shouldn't we have an exception for... situations in which the attorney-client relationship has been severed so that the statute begins to that point in time, which would be before the case has been concluded. Why shouldn't we have that exception?
Well, let's look at the policy considerations that are at play. You sever the attorney-client relationship, but then you're going to force the clients to assert inconsistent positions by filing the second lawsuit. That's going to imperil the attorney-client privilege, and you're also it's also judicially inefficient, and it promotes more malpractice claims than there otherwise would be, because you're forcing someone now, if that litigation goes on for some time, you're forcing them to sue someone where the legal system might sort through the claim and find a way that that the client didn't suffer any damages. So you're forcing the client. You know, in defense, if I was the malpractice defendant, I would want the system to have a chance to resolve it, and then you wouldn't be sued for malpractice. So I just think if you look at the policies, there is always competing policies on both sides. But if you look at the policies, it's clear to me that the last five times the court decided this issue, it got it right.
Should the huge rule be applied, even if the application of the rule does not further the policies that were identified in the Hughes decision?
I believe that if you've got
which might be one of those absurd situations like we're talking about.
I think there might be that I think the way that the system should work is if you've got a rule, you've got to follow it. Sometimes it may seem a little bit unusual, but that's the price you have to pay. It's worth it because there's more predictability, and predictability is an important value. And that's, Wiener versus Wasson, this court said that clarity and the legitimacy of the judiciary is predicated on the stability of decision-making process, and you need to have some rules. If you make everything into a case-by-case basis, then there's no predictability, and so that's part of the price you pay. But if there is a truly absurd situation, certainly you may want to make a hard case exception on the facts of that case, or if you can categorize it something, then you might consider having an exception, and that there's a kind of a sub-rule to it. But the competing rules in this case are a settlement rule, and perhaps in the alternative, a termination of representation rule from the respondents, and then the judicial finality rule that to us is just a bright line rule, because anyone can go down to the courthouse and find out when the dismissal order was entered and find out when the case was over. And that just provides a lot of certainty, and it avoids all the bad policy. It's very efficient for the judicial system. And under their rule, when does settlement occur? In this case, they're going to tell you, well, we've got the plaintiff's lawyer in the underlying case saying the case settled in January 1995, and here's why. Well, we've got affidavits from two of the defense counsel saying, no, it didn't settle at that time. And so it's clear. There's so many disputes. In fact, the fact of this case show why the settlement rule is no good, because that rule will spawn unnecessary satellite litigation regarding what was the date of settlement.
Most parties to a lawsuit know when they've settled their case?
No, Your Honor, because, I mean, they know when the case is over. But, I mean, there's all kinds of fact patterns that can intervene, especially if you're doing something important, like when limitation starts.
It's not unusual for there to be fact questions associated with making a determination about whether a claim is barred by limitation. That's not an unusual situation.
Well, I think most of the difficulties that arise in that regard, in my belief, is with the discovery rule. That is something that the policy for that is it's unfair to the client if they didn't know, if it was inherently undiscoverable and they didn't know about it. We don't want to cut them off. But the policies here are just the opposite, because if you've got a settlement rule, you're putting the burden on the victim of the malpractice to monitor the lawyer and figure out, well, what was the settlement date so I'll know when my limitation starts running. So it's the policies of the discovery rule are just the opposite. They mitigate against the settlement rule, because what's the burdens of the Hughes rule? All that means is the malpractice defendants have an incentive to file their dismissal papers, and there's usually a very small gap between the settlement of a case and then the end of the underlying case when the dismissal order is filed with the court. But what's the price? It's a huge price in unnecessary satellite litigation and increased cost to the judicial system. So it seems to me that the Hughes rule is a bright line rule, and it best serves all the policies that need to be served. And on stare decisis principles, obviously this court should strongly consider the issues of efficiency, fairness, and legitimacy. You don't want to be changing rules so often. I mean, the Hughes case was strongly endorsed the last five times this court looked at it. And to me, it should be continued forward, because when does settlement occur? I mean, there's often multiple defendants. Do you go by when all of them sign off on the settlement documents? What if there's...
Is there a fact issue listed in this case?
Well, there's clear, at a minimum, there's clearly a fact issue because there was affidavits that were contradictory, that were in the summary judgment evidence. I would say it's a matter of law because the settlement document, which is in the packet that we provided to the court, the settlement document has an integration clause, and that was after the alleged letter to Judge Cobb's clerk that they claim is the settlement of the case. So there's an integration clause there. So under the parole evidence rule, we believe that as a matter of law, their proof is inadmissible and incompetent under the parole evidence rule. And so therefore, the only competent evidence in the record would show that the case was settled in April of 95, which was less than 2 years before the case was filed. But in the alternative, at the very least, there's a fact issue. And this just shows all the increased satellite litigation that will occur under the settlement rule. The Hughes rule is clear, it's fair to all the parties involved, and it satisfies best all the policy decisions this court has shown. And the settlement rule on the termination of the lawyer rule did
not
do so.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bond.
May it please the court, Mr. Billy Shepherd and Mr. George Gamel present argument for the respondents. Mr. Shepherd will open for the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court, good morning. To affirm the summary judgments at issue in this case, the court need not decide whether Hughes versus Mahaney and Higgins is the law, whether Murphy versus Campbell is the law, or whether neither of them are the law. And the reason is that Apex, more than 2 years before this case was filed, agreed to settle the underlying case. And therefore, even if Hughes is the law, which provides the latest date for the statute of limitations to commence, Hughes tolling stopped on the day that Apex agreed to settle the underlying case. That day was January 27, 1995. Apex's lawyer, Ken Kirkendall of the Royston Razor Law Firm, wrote the plaintiff's lawyer, Ernest Cannon, a letter. Mr. Kirkendall specified that he was authorized to settle the case for $4,500,000 plus a specified amount of court cost. Mr. Kirkendall went on to say that we have agreed that this settlement, Mr. Kirkendall didn't say I anticipate a settlement or this is a settlement offer. He said that we have agreed that this settlement. This evidence.
How does all this dovetail with what was going on in the federal courts?
Excuse me?
How does all this dovetail with what was going on in terms of resolving the maritime law issue?
Well, on the same, actually, the letter from Mr. Kirkendall and Mr. Cannon was a BPS attached to a letter from Mr. Kirkendall to the federal court, where Mr. Kirkendall advises the federal court that on January 27, 1995, he'd received authority to settle the case, and therefore there would be no need for the federal court to rule on any of the pending motions because of the settlement, and that Apex, in fact, was not going to respond to any of the pending motions because of the settlement. Because
have you never had an experience with a letter like this when it finally came down to pay the money that there was still a dispute?
That, in fact, can happen. However, because the underlying case was a maritime case, the law is clear that federal law applies to the determination of whether this constituted an enforceable settlement. And federal law is clear that even simply a settlement memorialized by correspondence between counsel is not just enforceable in a maritime case, it is summarily enforceable by a motion to enforce. Federal law is also clear.
But your point is that people, even though they have this, it's still in question that somebody may have to bring some action enforcement. I mean, by federal law, they've already determined that, yes, we can summarily enforce it and go to court and get a summary judgment on this.
Well, in fact, it's less than a summary judgment. In state court, you might have to get a summary judgment. In federal court, you could do it by way of a motion to enforce. But as of this time, it was enforceable if someone would have backed out, and no one did. The case settled exactly on these terms.
So the affidavits of some defense attorneys that was referenced here is immaterial.
The affidavits are wholly irrelevant.
So you're saying don't apply Hughes, don't apply Murphy.
Actually, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is if you apply Hughes on this date, January 27th, 1995, Hughes tolling stopped because neither of the policy implications in Hughes were applicable anymore.
Well, now that goes back to our question that we've been debating all morning, and that is Hughes a bright line rule so that you look for the exhaustion of court activity in the case, or are we going to look at what point in time the policies of Hughes are no longer furthered so that we can look at things on a case-by-case basis?
I think the proper analysis is to look at things on a case-by-case basis like the court does with every case.
Do you agree that if we were to disagree with you on that point and say that Hughes was a bright-line test, that we would instead be looking at the point in time in which the court acted upon the settlement by dismissing the case, because that would be our finality, judgment, exhaustion of court action, whatever we would like to call that rule. A bright line application of Hughes would push the date later.
I would agree with that, except that if Hughes was modified by Murphy.
Well, let's put that aside for a second. Just the straightforward question, under the rule stated in Hughes, would the date then actually be later in January?
Yes.
So we would have to look at the policy reasons or a modification, Murphy modification, in order to get where you want us to go.
Yes.
Okay. Also, you're saying that because of this settlement, it would not implicate any attorney-client privileged information. If the client, in filing the claim against the first lawyer, were to assert certain claims that the lawyer, Ernie Cannon, whoever the lawyer was, would find out about and be able to use in the underlying case, that wouldn't occur because the case had already been settled.
Could not occur because this settlement is enforceable. In fact, Apex would not have to take any position in the underlying case, just like Mr. Kirkendall advised the federal court right here. We're not going to respond to the motions. We don't have to take any position. Likewise, with respect to the second policy consideration in Hughes concerning the viability of the legal malpractice case being dependent upon the outcome of the underlying case, that is no longer implicated here because damages are fixed. We have $4,500,000 and a specified amount of court cost. So the viability consideration is not implicated either. And I do want to say one thing.
Mr. Shepard, then, the way we would approach these cases is not by looking for the date at which we have a final judgment and the date at which all appeals have been exhausted, but instead we get out the list of policy reasons for fees, analyze the facts of a particular case, and determine whether or not the policy, at what point in time, furtherance of those policies was no longer at stake.
I believe that is the appropriate and fair way, and the list is short. It's just two policy considerations.
We would analyze each case on a case-by-case basis and determine whether those policy considerations are furthered from a particular point in time on, and if they're not, then that's the test, as opposed to looking at the finality of the judgment.
I agree with that, and that is exactly what the Dallas Court of Appeals did and held in Deere versus Scottsdale Insurance when the court held that the statute did not commence when the settlement papers were signed or when the judgment or dismissal order was entered, but when there was an agreement to settle. And with respect to analyzing the policy considerations, I do want to make one point about the second Hughes policy considerations, and that is perhaps if the underlying case turns out one way, there will not be a legal malpractice case. And I believe that the weight of that consideration today no longer is as great as it was in 1992 when Hughes was decided because of this court's recent decision in Burrow versus Arce and extending fee forfeiture to cases where there are no other damages. So the law today is, even if we have a case where there are no damages, and even if the Court of Appeals or this court ultimately decides a case such that there are no quote-unquote legal malpractice damages, we could still have a legal malpractice case based on this court's decision in the RC versus Burrow opinion. Apex has stated, and we strongly disagree, that...
Excuse me. I'm a little... The Burroughs versus RC is based on a breach of fiduciary duty theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that, I guess, tort-related in your view?
It can be.
Still a legal malpractice?
For example, in this case, it involves a limitation of liability action. Assuming that there were an allegation that Bickenstein and Oxford and Tolan did not advise the clients that no limitation of liability action was filed and that one could or should have been filed, a plaintiff's lawyer will make an argument that that's a breach of fiduciary duty and can argue fee disgorgement based on that, and it may well have to go all the way to trial based on Burrow versus Arce. Apex has argued that their case is somehow saved by Section 16.064 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and I want to talk briefly about that. The law is clear that even at the summary judgment level, to get the benefit of Section 16.064, it is the plaintiff's burden to prove two things, and that is that the other case was dismissed, and secondly, that the other case was dismissed because of lack of jurisdiction. The court in Malgram versus Inverness Forest held that a voluntary dismissal is not good enough. It's not going to trigger Section 16.064. What happened here was that the plaintiffs filed this case in Louisiana and prosecuted it for 18 months, shortly before the Louisiana case was dismissed. On the plaintiff's voluntary motion, they filed the case in Texas. The reason Section 16.064 doesn't help the Apex here is that the order of dismissal in the Louisiana case specifically says that the case is dismissed on the plaintiff's motion to dismiss all defendants. Nothing about jurisdiction. The Louisiana court never made a finding that there was no jurisdiction over Bickenstein and Oxford or Tolan. The Louisiana court even issued something called reasons for opinion. It's kind of like a little trial court opinion. It tells you why we did what we did. Nothing in that opinion says that the case was dismissed for jurisdictional reasons, and therefore Section 16.064 is not implicated. It's the plaintiff's burden to prove that the case was dismissed because of lack of jurisdiction, and there's no proof in the record, none whatsoever, that Louisiana case was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. In fact, the proof is directly to the contrary. The proof says the case was dismissed on Apex's voluntary motion to dismiss without prejudice. And under the Malgram case, that is not sufficient to implicate 16.064. And under the Orem versus General American case, it specifically says when the order doesn't say it was dismissed for jurisdiction, it's not good enough. 16.064 doesn't apply. Additionally, 16.064 has a provision that says if a case is filed in intentional disregard of jurisdiction, it's not going to apply, even if it is dismissed for want of jurisdiction. That is what we have here. In the case of Hobbit versus Schlumberger, the court held that if a litigant chooses for tactical reasons to litigate in a state, in a jurisdiction, where it is ultimately determined that there is no jurisdiction, we're not going to implicate Section 16.064 to save the statute of limitations for that litigant. What happened here was that very shortly after the underlying case was dismissed, the plaintiffs chose to sue a Texas law firm over a Texas case that involved a Mississippi accident in New Orleans, Louisiana. The plaintiffs prosecuted that case for 18 months, didn't like the way it was going, so they filed the Texas case and then voluntarily dismissed the Louisiana case. What they've done is they made a tactical decision to forum shop, to sue a Texas law firm over a Texas case over a Mississippi accident in New Orleans, and it backfired. That's plain and simple. They don't get the benefit of Section 16.064. I want to add that to the extent that the court finds that there is some sort of conflict between Murphy and Hughes,
Is there one?
There may not be one, Your Honor, and the reason is this. In Hughes, Mahaney withdrew under the witness advocate rule. It doesn't say that either Mahaney or his law firm did not continue to represent the Hugheses in an advisory capacity, in a non-advocacy capacity. If the Mahaney and Higgins law firm or Mahaney himself continued to advise the Hugheses in any fashion after the withdrawal under the witness advocate rule, the decisions in Hughes versus Mahaney and Higgins and the decisions in Murphy versus Campbell do not conflict at all. In fact, they're perfectly consistent.
But that's a big if, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if it's a big if, Your Honor.
It's not in the opinion.
Well, What I do know is that in the opinion in Murphy versus Campbell, Justice Heck wrote that in Hughes, the Hugheses would have to have sued the lawyer that's still representing them. So that to me suggests that Mahaney and Higgins were at least in a non-advocacy capacity, which would have been perfectly appropriate, still advising the Hugheses.
But in this case, the Beaumont court held, when in context of the argument you're now making, the court has, this court has subsequently narrowed the tolling provision to situation where the client is continuing to use the same lawyer in the pending litigation. And that's where the interpretations come that make an alleged difference between that Murphy did something to Hughes.
I understand. And because I don't know all of the facts of Hughes and I've investigated them, I don't know whether they're inconsistent or not, but they may well not be, and based on Justice Heck's opinion in Murphy versus Campbell, it suggests to me that they're not inconsistent at all. And the reason I think that Murphy is the better rule of law is because under Murphy, the plaintiff still has until the later of.
Well, would you have to hold that what you're saying is correct, that Murphy is a rule of law rather than an observation about what happened?
Do not. Don't even have to get to whether Murphy's a rule of law to affirm the summary judgments here.
Oh, I understand that, but that's not your argument now.
My argument is that even if the court were to find that this were not a binding settlement agreement, or for some reason, as Justice Hankinson has questioned, we should always have a bright line rule and turn a blind eye to the policy considerations under Hughes. We believe that...
Well, but I thought you agreed with it, too, that the policy conditions apply because you apply the facts of the case to the policy reasons and see where you are there.
I agree that that should be the law. But if we were to have an absolute... If Hughes means we always have an absolute bright-line rule without consideration of whether the policy considerations still apply, we believe that the controlling law is Murphy and that Murphy is the better rule of law because under Murphy, the plaintiffs have until the later...
If Murphy says what Murphy says, then wouldn't the result have had to have been different in Hughes based on what Hughes says? Not what Murphy says about Hughes,
well,
but on the face of the two opinions. On the face of the two opinions, Hughes indicates that the lawyer was relieved of his obligations to represent the client.
I read Hughes a little differently, and that's why I'm struggling with this. I believe that on the face of the Hughes opinion, it says that Mahaney withdrew from his position as an advocate. It says he withdrew under the witness advocate rule. That doesn't mean he didn't continue to counsel the Hugheses. And under the facts of that case, I would find it surprising if he did not.
That's just pure speculation. To base the whole change on this whole business on the speculation that he may have continued to advise them, therefore he was still in the case, therefore we have this big change.
All I'm doing is saying that Hughes, in response to the initial question that was asked by Justice Heck, that Hughes and Murphy may not necessarily conflict based on, quite frankly, something that Justice Heck wrote in Murphy about Hughes.
Any more questions for this?
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Michael Chumail. I represent Abraham Mulladull and Bland. They were the Louisiana law firm which replaced Finkenstein Oxford in this case. And I want to first address the issue that Oxford was replaced by my client approximately 9 to 12 months after Oxford entered the case. I don't see how this case has joint several liability between these law firms because any wrong that Bland committed is separate and distinct from any wrong that Oxford may have committed. The fundamental wrong in this case is a failure to file a limitation of liability pleading, and that's why you have a case involving an adoption, which sets this rule out, which is a strange kind of a case to begin with, and then you have a limitation of liability, which is a strange proceeding. It's a quirky proceeding, and it has to be filed within 6 months. Oxford did not file. If it would have been filed, the client knows it because the case has stayed and it goes to federal court. So the litigants knew it. When Bland took this case over and went and tried it, Apex was on notice through Bland that no limitation of liability had been filed. And to the extent that Apex could have sued Oxford, that, in my opinion, as somebody, as a maritime lawyer, that cause of action accrued at the date of the verdict, because you can never rectify that cause of action. You, no matter when, once 6 months is gone, there is no Murphy inconsistency there which would prevent a lawsuit against Oxford's firm. He failed to meet it, that deadline. There's nothing he can do to go back and file it. The reason the verdict crystallizes that is then the damages are clear because the verdict exceeds the value of the vessel. To the extent the settlement has any play, it's the mitigation of the damages. That would have been pleaded in the lawsuit by Oxford had they not done it. So if this
position,
court...
But the position wouldn't necessarily be inconsistent, except that until you got to the judgment, you wouldn't know if you had any damages.
That's correct. That once on August 31st, 1994, that's the verdict. That's when Oxford's malpractice, if any, occurred. You don't need to go to address the Murphy issues, and you've asked a lot of questions about Murphy today. The only problem in Murphy, in all of this, is the conclusion the judge reached. When Justice Cornyn decided it, his logic is not, I concur with the logic of Murphy, except he, at the end of it,
it's Hughes, isn't it, Judge?
I mean, in Hughes' opinion, at the end of it, he makes this statement, therefore we hold that when an attorney commits the malpractice, and he applies it across the board. And that's the problem. You can't take the Hughes logic and say it applies to every malpractice situation, because you have legal situations where damages are crystallized during the course of litigation, and there should be a claim made, for instance, against Oxford here. If they really thought he did something wrong, they should have put him on notice right there. They had Bland to do it, then they had Kuykendall to do it. So they had two chances to put Oxford on notice and to use the judicial system to end all this litigation instead of going forum shopping and trying to play Bland against Oxford in Louisiana. Because if you notice, when the case is dismissed in Louisiana, Bland, the case pins for 18 months. Bland doesn't even make an appearance because they're trying to leverage Bland against Oxford in a Louisiana court. And that is no reason under the logic of Murphy or under the logic of Hughes. Why should somebody be rewarded for fostering litigation beyond the 2-year period?
Any other questions?
No. Okay.
Thank you, Counsel.
Respond to opposing counsel's suggestion that the Hughes policy issues are not implicated here because of the settlement.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be glad to. The Hughes policy implications, the Hughes policies are implicated very much so because they're saying that in January of 95 the case was settled. But there's no evidence in the record Apex got a copy of this letter. There was a $100,000 claim by Halliburton against Apex in the underlying case. That's not addressed anywhere here. This is only signed by Mr. Kuykendall, no one else. And according to his affidavit, he sent a blind PS to Mr. Cannon. And according to him, what the PS meant was that you know, I can, the number is $4.5 million, and if I can pay $4.5 million to settle Halliburton's claims, as well as the plaintiff's claims, the Irvin's claims, then we can work, see if we can work out some kind of settlement. That's what Mr. Kuykendall said. And
who's he representing?
He was representing Apex, my client.
You say there's no indication that Apex got a copy of the letter?
Yes, Your Honor.
The lawyer wrote it.
He did, yes, that's true. But I mean, it's not required that he sent them the copy of the letter at the same time.
Is he the agent for the client?
Right, but that's the point, is that it's a client monitoring rationale of Sanchez, that under the settlement rule, you have to always be, the Apex has to monitor, because what happens is, if the lawyer gets sued for malpractice, they may start pulling things out of their files and saying, here's a settlement, we settled at this point, we settled at this point. And so, and also, because the settlement, really, this is not a settlement is the main thing, and because it's not a settlement, it may have, there's still a risk to Apex that it might have to assert inconsistent positions. This is a Limitations Act case, and their allegation against the defendants is they didn't file a timely Limitations Act case.
Was the ultimate settlement different from this letter?
Well, yeah, the ultimate settlement involved Halliburton taking a 50% discount on their judgment against Apex, and that's not, there's nothing in here about that. And Halliburton's own lawyer filed an affidavit saying that the case wasn't settled until March of 1995. So the terms were still, and there's, we've got documents in the summary judgment proof showing that the terms were still being negotiated, and the settlement terms were not achieved until March 1995. So that's why I think the policies are still in play, because Apex doesn't know at this point that the settlement might fall apart, and we may have to continue to assert that the petition was timely, whereas in the malpractice case, we said that the petition was not timely. So there's an inconsistent position there that's being asserted. And I wanted to just do some house cleaning that we cited in our reply brief, that the Reedy versus Hughes case, which is the underlying case in the Hughes opinion. It's 846 Southwest 2nd 1, and that clearly says that the Mahaney and Higgins firm was no longer representing the parties at that time. So there's no mystery as to whether they continued forward in that litigation. But I just want to emphasize that this document shows that there'll be huge transaction costs if this court changes from the judicial finality rule of Hughes to a settlement
rule. Murphy could not have changed Hughes, because one of Hughes's policies was the inconsistent position, and Murphy could not have said that, well, that's no longer of concern if the lawyer's been fired. I don't read Murphy as really changing the underlying fundamental decision in Hughes.
No, Your Honor, Murphy did not change the judicial finality rule or the other four cases that followed Hughes, because Murphy did not involve legal malpractice. And so the issues implicated in legal malpractice tolling are not implicated and not discussed by Murphy. And Murphy just said that we're not going to extend it to accounting malpractice. I would point out that I believe in Hughes that this court considered different rules and decided that the best one is judicial finality. We think it's a bright-line rule. That is the best rule. By the way, the court also, I believe, although I can't say that I've investigated the cases, but I believe the court did cite some other tolling rules, and I believe some of them are common law tolling rules that are cited directly in the original Hughes case. And I just wanted to make that mention that. But the judicial finality rule is needed. Apex needs to know when their limitations is.
Were you here earlier when Mr. Hatchell was arguing?
Yes, Your Honor, I was.
You heard the cards on the table argument.
Right.
Briefly, what's your response to that?
I just think that doesn't, whatever benefit of that is, it doesn't justify the inefficiencies of the system, and I just think that the abatement process is not going to be tenable. The defendants may not agree to abatement, the trial judge may not agree to an abatement, and it doesn't give the system time to work things out, and so it's not judicially efficient.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the second part.
All rise.